The obsessive attention to specific details, not just on the part of jurors, but on the part of the public, which was reading the printed accounts, 9 printed versions of the trial transcript in the Parkman, Webster Parkman murder, it paved the way to our own interest in the O.J. Simpson case, the desire to track every bit of evidence, every splotch of blood, to construct diagrams, architectural diagrams of the various floors of the Harvard Medical College, mm-hmm. to trace every bit of bone in the skeleton to the various portions of the Harvard Medical College. There's a very powerful narrative need to reconstruct in great detail what happened.
Historian Karen Haltonen, she'll be back in just a moment to talk about murder and the Gothic imagination in American culture. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Because human communities differ so widely across time and tide, it's difficult to say what they all have in common. But one constant, universally shared, is an abhorrence of the crime of murder. Yet even this is subject to a variety of expressions, what one scholar refers to as the cultural construction of murder. Karen Haltonen teaches at the University of California at Davis. She says that during America's early years, religion was the dominant factor in shaping how people thought about and reacted to murder. But over the course of the last 200 years or so, that cultural construction has changed, shifting gradually from religion to more secular conceptions. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Karen Haltonen worked on a study entitled Murder and the Gothic Imagination in American Culture.
The crime of murder is regarded in most cultures as a dramatic and shocking act of human transgression. But the response to the crime in the late 17th century in New England was dramatically different from the response to the crime in our own time, in that late 17th century New Englanders believed in the doctrine of innate depravity. Mm-hmm. And when a murder took place, they were not terribly surprised that such an act could emanate from a completely depraved human nature.
They wouldn't look around and say, how can something awful like this happen? I mean, they sort of had a lower expectation about the nature of human nature.
I think that's a good way to put it. They believed that only evil acts could emanate from evil natures. They believed mm-hmm. that all human goodness was simply goodness sustained by Christ. And any departure from such goodness came as less of a surprise to them mm-hmm. than it does
how did
to us.
How did that translate into the legal system, into basically sort of what happened to the good guys and the bad guys, the victims, the way the victims were looked upon, all of that?
In the judicial system, the rate of conviction of crime was significantly higher than it is in our own. It's been estimated it was something like in the neighborhood of 90%, and the vast majority of convicted criminals confessed their crime. So once the judicial process had taken place, there was a fair degree of clarity about what had happened and who had done it. And the judicial confession was followed by a public confession at the scaffold before the execution, which was a direct speaking to the entire community.
One of the reasons for this, Karen, you observe, is that the judges were the clergy. We had it all balled together, religion and the state, and there was this notion of a kind of guiding morality in our early American society. Have I got this right?
The magistrates were not the same as the clergy, but they did act on behalf of the laws of God. They, in 17th century New England, the law was very much based on biblical law, and the magistrates worked hand in glove with the clergy mm-hmm. in making sure that those who defied that law were properly punished.
Now, one of the emblems that stayed in my mind when I looked at your work, Karen, was this sort of divine eye notion. That is to say, God in his or her heaven looking down on the earth and really understanding what's going on and giving a kind of moral coherence, if not consolation, to the people, so to speak, when something awful like a murder occurs. Tell me about that.
Once the execution had taken place, an execution sermon was frequently printed. The sermon preached by the clergy at the scaffold was printed. And the clergy informed readers of that sermon that the providential eye had overseen the crime and had ensured the punishment of the guilty party, and there was a kind of moral closure on the event. Mm-hmm. God had seen it, God had exposed it, justice had been done. The whole act was wrapped up in a moral package at the end as a warning to others not to act on their own depraved natures and do likewise. Uh-huh. And there was simply a closure to that event that I think is lacking in our contemporary culture and has been lacking since the early 19th century.
Now, as time went on and America became more of a secular society, the clergy lost much of its power in terms of our public culture. We come to a juncture in understanding the act of murder and retribution and punishment and all of that, that is much more ambiguous. It's much more difficult for the people to figure out what's going on. Fill this one in for me.
After the mid-18th century, with the Enlightenment, which undermined the cultural authority of the clergy and which redefined human nature as essentially neutral, if not morally good, the crime of murder was responded to in a brand new way.
Well, because of rationality, that is to say, science comes along at this time. We can figure this out. God doesn't have to solve this problem for us.
Exactly. The God of the 18th century worked through predictable natural laws more than through dramatic sudden interventions. Uh-huh. His law was deemed knowable. Man was deemed a reasonable, rational creature, capable of self-government, capable of acting freely on his or her moral nature. Mm-hmm. And the crime of murder became more astonishing.
Now, when we look back at this contrast between the sort of divine and the secular views of the act of murder and its consequences in our society, you can't second guess the record, I suppose, Karen, but do you find cases where people were unjustly punished because they felt such an enormous amount of pressure to sort of fess up and come clean? You said that 90%, there was a conviction rate of, you know, almost 100%. Was justice at work in all of this?
Well, of course, as an historian, I'm dealing in hindsight on that, and I'm never entirely sure. But I do think that justice tended to prevail in the various cases that I have seen. I think there was considerable pressure to confess. But there were such terrible spiritual penalties on lying before God that there was a disinclination to confess to a crime that hadn't been committed. In fact, the reason 19 people were hanged for witchcraft in Salem Village in 1692 and 93 was that they refused to perjure themselves by confessing to witchcraft. Those who confessed to the crime of witchcraft actually went free. They were not executed.
Now, give me a couple of examples. You've mentioned Salem in 1692 and 1693. Is there a particularly colorful or sensational example that comes to mind of murder in early America that sort of illustrates this notion of divine guidance, intervention, all of that?
The infanticides committed by Esther Rogers in 1703 are probably a good example.
Tell me about this.
Esther Rogers was a young servant, single woman, who confessed to the murder of one child and in the course of that confession admitted that she had killed a previous child as well. Three execution sermons were preached before her execution at the scaffold, and she confessed fully of her crime. And acknowledged that she was a sinner, she was an innately depraved sinner, but that she had closed with Christ, that she had hope in her own salvation before her death. It was a very exemplary case because she behaved properly at the scaffold.
Well, now that has a ring, an echo in our modern society. It's not uncommon regardless of what state we're talking about, when the death penalty obtains for the condemned, the criminals to all of, if not a last minute conversion, they preach to the public about their spiritual feelings. There is a continuity here.
Yes, yes. And they tended to behave themselves very well at the scaffold. With one exception, I think the social group of pirates tended to misbehave at the scaffold. But with that exception, most convicted murderers, having been given 6 months usually between the sentencing and the execution of sentence in order to work on their souls, in order to receive the clergy in the jail cell and prepare for execution, usually behave themselves well
Would you say, is there a class thing at work here, Karen, in the sense that there was a class of criminals, you know, kind of like the fallen angels? If everybody believed we lived in a fallen world, statistics indicate that we're going to have X number of people who are going to belong in that category. How about it?
Well, there are certain social groups that are probably overrepresented in the execution sermon literature. Servants mm-hmm. is one. Black servants in particular is another. Young laboring men, single women, one of the most common of crimes was infanticide, so single women were overrepresented there. But there was no real sense of an underclass or a criminal class such as evolved or emerged in the 19th century.
It was a weakness in human nature.
Exactly, and it was universally shared. And the people present at the execution were encouraged to thank God that there but for the grace of God went they, that any one of them was capable of committing the same act.
Now, move us forward in time, Karen Haltonen. You're writing about murder and the Gothic imagination in American culture. You want to come what, up to the middle of the 19th century, the beginning of the 19th
Mid
century?
Mid to late 19th century,
What goes on there? How does the attitude change?
After the Enlightenment, the imagination of criminality in America turns to what I call certain Gothic conventions for comprehending the crime, notably the convention of horror and the convention of mystery. Mm-hmm. And these are conventions with which we are very familiar from our own popular literature. There is a Gothic fiction of horror, and of course the murder mystery is the best example of the other convention.
Well, not to mention the fact that there was a kind of parallel expression of these phenomena in popular culture, shall we call it that?
Sure.
In the early 19th century, we have Gothic mysteries and romances. They're certainly not brand new on the shelves at B. Dalton, are they?
Right. Gothic fiction first emerged in English literature in the 1760s. It very, very quickly became a popular genre. It was imported in large quantities into the colonies. And then in our own American Renaissance, writers such as Poe and Hawthorne and Melville were really masters of the Gothic fiction genre. What happens in true crime literature, what we would call true crime literature, is that those same conventions of horror that shaped Gothic fiction came to shape the popular understanding of the crime of murder.
Well, now, the supernatural also figures in this, but not in a way that is directly comparable to that guiding hand of God sort of notion that informed public culture in the 17th century. Am I on the right track there?
Right. There's very little attention, ironically, to the supernatural in the earlier literature. Hmm. In a world that accepted the supernatural as natural, saw no real distinction, all events take place in the cosmos because of God's action. There was no particular fascination with so-called supernatural occurrences. It's only in the 19th century, after the emergence of a rational worldview, that people become intensely interested in what we would call superstition. A mysterious light appeared over the grave of the victim. Mm-hmm. A black bird arose suddenly in the room after John Leckler killed his wife for infidelity.
Oh my goodness.
Because those events did not make sense within a rational, naturalistic cosmos, they drew more attention.
Karen, we're talking about your project, Murder and the Gothic Imagination in American Culture. Tell me about what you refer to as the cultural construction of murder. I take it you're talking about the popular culture and what goes on in the courtroom, that sort of thing?
Exactly. In the late 18th and early 19th century, the earlier theological literature of murder, consisting largely of execution sermons, gave way to a new kind of genre which focused on legal accounts of the crime. From our contemporary perspective, it was an early foreshadowing of court TV, I suppose you might say. Trial transcripts were printed about the crime. And once the execution sermon was replaced by the trial transcript, a new uncertainty crept into the popular comprehension of the crime.
Uncertainty in the sense that what, we have multiple endings, multiple interpretations?
Exactly. Multiple possibilities, often non-closure. If the only printed account of a given crime that everyone has heard about ends in the acquittal of the person charged, then there's no closure at all.
We can talk about it endlessly.
Exactly. Exactly. And sometimes it was deemed necessary to keep reprinting new possibilities for what had happened because closure was not achieved in the courtroom. Under an adversarial system of justice where prosecutors and defenders are effectively debating what really happened, even when there is a conviction The reader is free, of course, to conclude that someone was convicted wrongly.
Well, the key to this is the term you just used here, the adversarial nature of the crime. It's a competition of stories. My story is going to be better than your story.
Right. Right. I call it dueling storytellers, where two storytellers or more stand up before the jury and treat the jury as readers. And say, here's my story, and I want you to believe this.
Is it too much of a stretch to say that this is the kind of thing that may have inspired people like Poe and Hawthorne to write the fiction that they did?
I think that Poe actually responded to a series of specific murders in his short stories. I've never tracked this year by year, but there are several cases that I think gave him the inspiration for various stories. For example, his story, The Black Cat, was printed several years after a murder in New Jersey in which the discovery of the body was contingent on the presence of the cat behaving in a peculiar way in the cellar where the body was buried. So I think Poe routinely combed through my literature, the popular nonfiction of murder, looking for ideas.
Where was Geraldo when we needed him, huh? Tell me about the murder of Dr. Parkman. Now, it's a very complicated story, and I'm going to challenge you here to tell it in just a couple of minutes. But what happened
there? This was one of the most sensational cases of the 19th century, probably the most sensational case before the Lizzie Borden murders. In 1849, Dr. George Parkman, a very wealthy real estate speculator in Boston, disappeared and was traced to the Harvard Medical College, to the laboratory of Professor John Webster.
My goodness.
The story is complicated, but in the week that followed, search after search was launched, honing in on the Harvard Medical College, and finally the body was discovered in fragments distributed throughout the college.
Where, again, Michael Crichton, where was he when we needed him? And what happened? What was the upshot here?
Dr. John Webster was charged with the crime on the basis of extensive circumstantial evidence. And the case drew a great deal of attention, partly because when one Harvard man kills another Harvard man, there is a great deal of interest. These men were of high social standing. The murder was peculiarly grisly because of the dismemberment and disposal of the body. But I think it's the popularity of this case is best explained by its appeal to mystery, by the way the story forced readers, for initially jurors and eventually readers, to try to reconstruct what had happened on the basis of these found body parts.
Now, we have managed to avoid it up to this point, Karen, but O.J. comes to mind here, the Simpson trial. We're recording this conversation in the late spring of 1995. We don't know what the results of the trial will be, but it sounds to me like the Parkman case is the kind of thing that set the popular imagination on the track that it's still on today.
Right.
How about it?
The obsessive attention to specific details, not just on the part of jurors, but on the part of the public, which was reading the printed accounts, nine printed versions of the trial transcript in the Parkman, Webster Parkman murder, it paved the way to our own interest in the O.J. Simpson case. The desire to track every bit of evidence, every splotch of blood, to construct diagrams, architectural diagrams of the various floors of the Harvard Medical College, to trace every bit of bone in the skeleton to the various portions of the Harvard Medical College. There's a very powerful narrative need to reconstruct in great detail what happened in a given case.
Is it fair to say that when the public reacts the way it does to cases like O.J. Simpson or Dr. Parkman, it's more than journalism at work here. It's more than the messenger taking these stories out to the public. Or should we look at the journalists, the media, and say, no, you guys are the ones that are responsible for these public obsessions?
I think it's more than journalism, and I think it's more than law, and I think it's even more than sensationalism. I think we are inclined to despair over the level of popular interest in a case such as the O.J. Simpson case. But I take such attention very seriously, whether it appears on CNN or in the tabloid newspapers in the lines at the grocery store. I think it represents an effort to come to terms with the problem of human evil. I think people are fascinated by the Simpson case because they are trying to imagine the possibility that a man could kill his former wife, because they don't have a clear comprehension of the nature of human nature. They're not quite clear as to whether human beings are innately sinful or capable of such heinous sin.
Are there other murder mysteries, so to speak, that you know about that deserve attention, that are as compelling as that? What is it, a question of publicity at work here?
I think, given the way our media work, we do find, by definition, we find the most compelling cases. I guess this is a perfect system kind of answer. If it gets the attention, I think it's because the public is fascinated by this particular kind of crime.
Does it deserve the public attention?
Well, that's a moral question that I'm not really prepared to answer. I think we pay a great deal of attention, for example, to crimes of domestic homicide, not just the O.J. Simpson case right now, but the Susan Smith case in South Carolina, because we have a deadly fascination with the idea of terrible violence breaking out in the allegedly the safest place in our culture. Those crimes do deserve a great deal of attention, I think, and they get it.
Well, one way of looking at it is to make it intensely individual, if not idiosyncratic. Could I do this? It is a mirror that the public in individual forms holds up to itself and asks these large sort of disturbing questions.
I think that's a very powerful component to our fascination. That's the question that a late 17th century New Englander wouldn't have had to spend much time on. Am I capable of doing this?
Yeah.
The answer is very simply
absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
In our own culture, we are terrified that it may be
right.
possible.
Well, this also helps to account for the enormous popularity and the endless supply of murder mysteries and detective stories and crime procedurals. And have I got that right? The
yes.
kind of thing where you're trying to figure out, you know, you alluded to the spatial, the architectural, the detail work that went into these trials. Nothing's new, I take it.
Since the early 19th century, I would say very little is new.
Well, apropos, Karen, of the popular attention to murder mysteries and detective fiction, I remember one of our trustees here at the National Humanities Center, who was a literary critic, saying that the murder mystery is the first form of philosophical deconstruction, where you go back in time and you got to put something together and you have these unclear, ambiguous starting and stopping points. Do you buy that argument?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what this person meant by deconstruction, but
nobody does.
I am certain that the murder mystery appeals to a very powerful narrative impulse because it requires that the reader construct the narrative herself or himself based on fragments.
We have to organize experience.
Exactly.
And
it comes at us in chaotic form, in fragmented form. It doubles back on itself in time.
Uh-huh.
It really captures the nature of experience as chaotic and indeterminate and very subjective. Murder mysteries present you with different witnesses who saw different things, different
mm-hmm.
accounts of the same event.
Sure.
And they're very demanding on readers.
Well, I can't let you get away without asking you if you read murder fiction or murder mysteries or detective fiction, and who's your favorite? Who really does it better than the rest?
I do read murder mysteries. I did not read them until I started this project, interestingly. I started reading it because I felt it was important to my work, and then, of course, I got hooked, and now
sure.
I'm something of an addict. I tend to read English women writers.
Uh-huh. Agatha Christie?
Not so much Agatha Christie.
More recent?
P.D. James,
uh-huh.
Ruth Rendell
mm-hmm.
are my favorites.
What about on this side of the Atlantic? Have you got any favorite American murder mystery writers?
Sarah Paretsky is uh-huh. my favorite.
And why is that? Is there a specific sort of reason?
Well, I would say the first reason is that she is so very, very smart. I think she's among the most intelligent of writers. She takes on major powerful institutions
uh-huh.
and moves inside them and exposes evil and corruption in their corridors.
Uh-huh. Sort of like God in the 17th century. She looks
yes,
down and has this
yes,
omniscient view.
The private eye replacing the providential eye.
Uh-huh.
I also lived in Chicago for 12 years and like the car chases in Sarah Paretsky.
But back to the other side of the Atlantic momentarily, Karen, what about Sherlock Holmes? Is that the archetype when we look to murder mystery and murder fiction?
I would say that Sherlock Holmes is the classic example of a detective from the golden age of detective fiction. And what makes him classic is that he is providential in his omniscience.
Yeah, he's like God.
He is very much like God. He knows all. He sees all. He can deduce things from miles away. He can get a single fragment of information and reconstruct
right.
an entire story. And I think that kind of fiction is appealing to us because it restores order to a world that has been torn apart by the uh-huh. heinous act of of a crime.
Not only order, but a form of consolation, it's a kind of balm that there are ways out of these terrible thickets of our behavior.
Yes. And I think we seek detective fiction partly because we live in a world of true crime where actual acts of murder ultimately defy narrative closure, they defy full moral comprehension. We reach for the detective novel to find a kind of reassurance that there is moral order and that there is a Sherlock Holmes who will somehow get us out of here. The hard-boiled school of American detective fiction doesn't work quite so nicely.
And why is that?
It's a world that restores moral chaos, really.
Uh-huh. It's the action that counts and not the, hope of resolution.
Right. And even when the detective figures out what happened, there's frequently a note of despair on mm-hmm. which the story ends.
Here's a footnote to our conversation, Karen Halton. And again, you're working on a project called Murder and the Gothic Imagination in American Culture. You're a professional historian, a tenured professor at the University of California. Do you take heat because you're writing on things that appear to be to put it harshly, kind of trivial, the underpinnings of our culture rather than the great themes and the politicians and all of that sort of stuff? How about it?
I would have taken heat 20 or 30 years ago, but given the what has happened in the field of cultural history, I'm a cultural historian, I don't uh-huh. take much now.
You wouldn't tolerate it anyway.
I don't think so.
Karen Halton teaches at the University of California at Davis. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, she worked on a study entitled Murder and the Gothic Imagination in American Culture. Karen Halton is the author of Confidence Men and Painted Women, a study of middle-class culture in America, published by Yale University Press. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for a cassette tape of this program. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was historian Karen Haltonen. For a cassette tape of this discussion, send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 783. That's program number 783. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, from Orchard Country to Green River, poet Robert Morgan of Cornell University will be here to read from his work and to talk about poetry and modern American culture. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.